shouldn't get yourself sequenced if you're a worrier, you know. So that's a good, you know, if you're someone prone to anxiety, don't get yourself sequenced, because there will be a bunch of things with great uncertainty in them. I mean, there'll be tens of thousands of things with great uncertainty in them.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
Jazz musician, cardiologist, geneticist, engineer, entrepreneur, referee of kids soccer. Just some of the activities engaged in by our guest today, Stanford's Ewan Ashley, who just might be the most interesting man in Silicon Valley.
This is Tectonics. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Shaywitz, and today's episode is brought to you by DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data. So, Lisa, you and I have talked about the use of technology to enhance athletic performance. We interviewed the CEO of Whoop. We discussed the use of genetic tests to inform athletic performance, something I've been extremely skeptical about beyond the placebo effect, which strikes me as much like cupping.
Yeah, cupping. There's much better uses for cups, like filling them with bourbon.
There you go. Fortunately, our guest today is ideally suited to offer a perspective on genetic testing for athletes and other uses, and is engaged in conspicuously legitimate research in this area, which is itself reportable. So let's welcome to the program Ewan Ashley and ask where on the incredulometer he locates companies offering genetic tests for athletes and others. Welcome, Ewan.
Well, thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to be on.
Absolutely.
What a start. I'm not sure how to follow your introduction. But of course, yeah, this has been in the news so much recently because of the Olympics. And I think our focus is on extreme athletes and people performing at the highest end and the people who are trying to get them there. And the people who are trying to get them there include coaches and professional associations and many others with a vested interest. And so they're interested in anything that might make their athletes just go a little faster or run a little faster, jump a little higher. But unfortunately, when it comes to whether genetics can currently help us do that, the answer is pretty clear. For better or worse, the answer is genetics is nowhere right now in helping us get there.
And steroids are more effective, is your point?
I'm sure he didn't say that.
Which is not to say that we don't find the potential of genetic predisposition to athletic performance interesting. Of course, as a human race, we're fascinated by what makes people run fast and jump high. And clearly, there's a genetic component to that. And so I think we, in our group, we're particularly interested in that genetic component. One, because it's fascinating just by itself. But two, because we think it could be the key to helping us learn about biology that could really help us help those people who are not supreme athletic performers, but rather those who have disease. Patients, in other words, because in order to perform at the very highest level, everything needs to work. You know, it's like a racing car. Every single little thing has to work well. And there are particular parts of the physiology that have to work super well. And we think that by studying these elite athletes, we can actually help work out what the fundamental biology is, and that could help those with disease. But whether we can use that for prediction is very unclear right now.
I mean, it seems to me so interesting. So you're sort of, in a sense, recruiting the sort of these extreme phenotypes, basically, these athletes to try to understand the underlying biology. But meanwhile, it seems to me it's such an interesting window into the sort of the disconnect between the expectations and the reality of contemporary genetics, looking at specifically the use case of applying it to athletic performance. Could you maybe go into that a little bit about how the application and their commercial, you know, there are companies that are saying, oh, here, take this, you know, study, here's a gene panel based on your performance here, you know, based on your sequence or based on your variants. We can tell you what sports to do, what you should be eating. Could you sort of help explain both what some folks are trying to do, not specifically by company name necessarily, but where the disconnect is between sort of the popular understanding of the application of genetics and where the science is really at?
Yeah, well, I think that it really speaks to people's desire to just try and to use any little thing that can help them. And that comes on behalf of the athletes themselves, the coaches, the parents, whoever. I think that's where the desire comes from. And often where there's a desire, then there's a vacuum and people want to fill that vacuum. But I do think it is dangerous to fill that vacuum with what is essentially, at best, pseudoscience at this point. But certainly, there are a small number of markers that we have found to be associated. We and others have found to be associated with athletic performance. But it's a huge gap between that and even a very robust finding. And within this field, we don't even have very many robust findings, to be honest, compared to the rest of genetics. But even where there are some reasonably rigorous and replicated findings, it's a million miles away from being able to be used for predictive performance. And it's because even if you take the genetic components of athletic activity, which might be as much as 50%, it's often around 50%, how much of that 50% do we understand? And it's way less than single digits. You know, it's like 1%, maybe, and maybe not even that. So what you have is a test that speaks to less than 1% of your overall variability. And yet we have a much easier test, which is, you know, how high can you actually jump? And would you run as fast as you can over there for me, please? You know, they're quite easy tests to run.
so you know where I'm going to go with this. So if you just take the outline of what you just described, you have a test that maybe it accurately assessed, but some tiny fraction of variability. I'm listening to that and thinking, well, if I didn't know you were describing tests for athletic performance, I think you were describing a lot of pharmacogenomics.
Well, I think that, yeah, the obvious analogy, of course, is where we've heard about this more often, which is in the realm of more general health, predictive analytics for more general health, and pharmacogenomics. I think I might put pharmacogenomics aside for a moment and focus on the much more much closer parallel, which is this predictive analytics. So the idea of using SNPs, which have tended to be common. Increasingly, we have more rare examples of genetic variants. And the question as to whether they can help as part of the clinical workup for people with diabetes or coronary artery disease or high blood pressure. And there is certainly a difference between those two. They're on the same line. The difference is that we're now looking at studies with hundreds of thousands of people in them for those diseases, diabetes, coronary artery disease. Just in the last week, those group of papers on hypertension, within the last month, very important papers in diabetes. We've seen over the last few years important papers for coronary artery disease. We have moved from where sports genetics is today, which is virtually nowhere, to a point where we actually do have dozens of replicated variants for those diseases. So we're not quite in the same spot. However, from the perspective of do we yet have a good predictive analytic for those common and complex diseases that is really useful and certainly being used in clinical practice? Well, the answer is the same, that we do not yet. And so I think that we're optimistic we'll get there eventually, but we're not there even for these diseases that we now have studies where the numbers are in the hundreds of thousands.
I mean, it reminded me of the Dodo verdict, right, from Alice in Wonderland with sort of, you know, everybody has won and all deserve prizes, right? It
yeah.
seems that.
But there's, you know, I think it's such an interesting thing to contemplate. I was thinking about, you know, at NASA, they're doing some research comparing Mark and Scott Kelly, who are twins astronauts. One spent lots of time in space, one less so. What are the physical differences in their bodies as a result of that? And what about, you know, is anybody in sports looking at like the Manning brothers or people who are, you know, father-son relationships, you know, from football and what the genetic characteristics are that made, you know, two people from a family effective versus not, you know, like, you know, people whose children didn't turn out to be so hot. And I just wonder if there's anything there that's being done.
No, that's a great question. And actually, that underlies the idea behind some of our work, because I think that, I mean, if we go from the slightly scarier end of the application of genetics, either in sport or complex common disease, as we've just been discussing, to the place where clinical genomics is really certainly, if not in prime time, certainly in mainstream use within medicine, then where we are is genetic disease. And genetic disease is family disease. And so that's where we get significant power by being able to analyze people who are related because of the genetic material that they share. And certainly the more distantly they're related within a given family unit, the more closely they share a kind of rarer trait, then the more power we have to really work out what it is. And so absolutely, we are interested in families of elite athletes within the context of our study where we're sequencing really the fittest people on the planet. We're particularly interested in twins perhaps, but in fact, even more perhaps cousins, brothers, trios, because that does give us increased power for discovery, but we're actually trying to work out what the sorts of variants that might be helping them to that kind of achievement are.
What is the goal of your study? What are you trying to figure out by studying all of these people? What's sort of your immediate the immediate scientific question you're looking at?
Well, they're clearly trying to start breeding programs for moving up the draft.
Yeah, absolutely.
Helping Stanford out.
Fantasy football improvement.
Yeah, that's my new plan for global domination. No, of course, we're interested in the underlying biology. I mean, I think we all find extreme athletes fascinating. And my original degree was in exercise physiology, so I have a long history of thinking about elite athleticism and the physiology of sport and exercise. And now my world for the last decade has mostly been in genomics and genetics. And so bringing those together from a personal point of view is fairly obvious thing to do. But much of our inspiration for the study came from this story that you may be familiar with, from this cross-country skier, Finnish cross-country skier, Eero Mäntyranta, who was one of the most famous athletes in that field of cross-country skiing, and won many, many gold medals. I think it was 11 at various Olympics. But this shadow hung over him for many years that he might be blood doping, because every time his blood test was taken, he had a very high hematocrit, or a large number of red blood cells in his body. And so there was always this suspicion. And yet it turned out in the end that his family had a very rare form of erythrocytosis, where he actually had a genetic variant that was acting a bit like EPO, erythropoietin, which is the hormone that some of these athletes take illegally.
So he was like auto-doping, more or less.
Correct, yeah. So his was a form of kind of genetic variation doping that led to him having a very high blood count. And those blood cells are the ones that carry the oxygen to the tissues. And so you can imagine that is performance enhancing in the same way that...
So by studying this extreme performer, you were able to find this interesting variant. I mean, the writer, I think it's David Epstein, right, who's written obviously about this topic really thoughtfully. He had this other very interesting story about this woman who had this particularly, who is an athlete, particularly well-developed musculature. And they found that she had a mutation in common with a sort of a debilitating muscular condition, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's another fascinating story. I mean, his work is really amazing in the way that he writes about this. And in particular, this is a gene we know well, because the gene is lamin, which is a protein that's in the nucleus of multiple cells. But it's fascinating in many ways, because depending on how that gene is mutated, it can cause widely variant and divergent diseases. And so we have patients in our center at Stanford, where we look after patients with inherited cardiovascular disease who have hearts that are weak and that are prone to potentially fatal bad rhythms of the heart, or arrhythmias, because of mutations in that gene. And then there are others with weak muscles, and such as the woman who was focused on in that story. And then there's others, like the sprinter who was focused on, who had a mutation in the same gene, you know, who have just a slightly different mutation and yet a completely different effect.
So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, there's just massive amounts of money being poured into precision medicine right now, which is the ultimate, you know, commercial manifestation of all this in theory. You know, are we like way too soon to assume any of that's going to pay off? Is it, you know, are we so close to the beginning? Are we at the beginning of the beginning, not the end of the beginning, and that all this money that's being invested in companies for precision medicine is going to just evaporate for being too soon to market?
And to add to that question, there's this other exercise physiologist from the Mayo, right, Michael Joyner, who is a persistent critic of precision medicine. He, in the New York Times op-ed, criticized moonshot medicine. It seems like he has a second career as a critic of precision medicine, but he makes some points that would seem to be relevant for this conversation.
Yeah, so that, I mean, obviously a fascinating area, lots of great questions in there to unpack. First of all, I would say we're at the end of the beginning. Like, that's the simple answer to that part. And I've actually used that phrase a bunch of times. I think that we've been in these very early phases where 5 years ago we were sequencing genomes for the first time, amazed we could get it for $20,000, $10,000, $5,000, $1,000. And then we moved from the, wow, we can actually get that data, maybe we can analyze it a bit, to the point where we've said, look, we can take patients with mysterious and rare disease, and we can find the answer to what they have at a much higher rate than we ever could before. I mean, one of my roles is in the undiagnosed diseases program for the NIH. And these are people who go from doctor to doctor to doctor, generating notes that are a stack of notes that are as high as, you know, as high as your desk.
Yeah, these diagnostic odysseys, right?
Exactly. And not finding any answers. And then they come to a group of people who can do, who have many things in their armory, but one of the most important is genome and exome sequencing. And out the other end of that there's a 30 or 40% diagnostic rate. And that is not a trivial thing for these families that have been on these odysseys. This is even just knowing what they have is tremendously empowering. Now, of course, as the medical group, we really want to take it further and be able to treat them, and that can happen too. It's not in every single one of the cases where we get an answer, we immediately have a treatment. But in a significant minority of those cases, probably a third of those cases that we solve, there is a treatment suggested that can make a dramatic difference to that person's life.
It's really that high? I had no idea of that. My sense is that I appreciated the utility of being able to, you know, and obviously, as you appreciate, you know, disclosure, we're involved in a bunch of these sort of supporting a bunch of these efforts. But my general reading of the literature was that it's wonderful being able to end a diagnostic odyssey, but it's almost reportable if you wind up with something that you're able to come up with an effective intervention on.
It's a bunch of science for science's sake. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, I'm saying it's incredibly, just like you were saying, for the parents, instead of trying to figure out what's wrong, it gives them sort of a focus, you know, a focus and an understanding and sort of an end of this odyssey.
Yeah.
But that's not the same thing as saying, okay, well, can you fix your kid? That's what
The question I have is, at what point in the odyssey, you know, does somebody in the healthcare system stand up and say, this kid should be genetically tested? Because I got to believe that most of these families have gone on for years before anybody raises that flag. You know, I mean, there are not any primary care physicians out there, much less most specialists, who are going to end up in that place without, you know, a lot of pressure.
And I think maybe you can talk about the Undiagnosed Disease Network, because I think the goal of it is to kind of make sure folks, kids who need it, are triaged to this sort of to wind up in this expert network much quicker.
That's exactly right. And I mean, I think your points are very, very well taken. I mean, I think one of our aims, even in the Undiagnosed Diseases Network, where we're at the end of the line, is to move the technology earlier, because millions of dollars are spent on these kids and these families by the time they reach us. And so wouldn't it be better? In fact, we have some numbers that we're just beginning to put together on cost effectiveness of this approach, but doing the genetic testing at the exome level earlier to end the odyssey a little sooner and save the healthcare system money and save the angst from the family, which I think is powerful.
So how are you doing that? How are you getting the word out both to the physician community who would just send you on to the next guy for another test? And how are you getting this word out to the payer community who's, you know, already got their finger on the denial button to pay for these tests?
Well, so there is a denial button, is there? I always wondered if there was like a big red button.
It looks just like the easy button, but it's black.
right. I can imagine the noise it makes when you press it as well. Well, you know, the first thing is just getting the word out to physicians and to potential patients who have mystery syndromes that aren't solved. And we are spending our time, well, we're talking to your listeners, but there's a good start. We're trying to get the word out through the press. We're obviously publishing papers. We have websites, and we try, when we have good stories, to let journalists know so that they can write about them. And then we have professional methods of doing that too, through the genetic societies and others, and through specific clinics. So we really want to spread the word. I think, I mean, we can't see every patient, but we really want to do what we can. And if there's a huge waiting list, then that we can go back to the NIH and say, look, we need more centers.
So some of the different approaches that I've heard and some I'm familiar with are that one is that, you know, for a subset of sick kids, they get sort of whole genome or whole exome sequence sort of immediately. And then if you talk to folks like, you know, David Ledbetter at Geisinger, my understanding is he ultimately would love to be have a situation where when every child is born, they at least have the opportunity to have sequencing from birth. Do you have a view on that?
Well, yeah. So I think that one of the fun things about having been involved in this area the last few years is mixing it up. I mean, you mentioned Michael Joyner earlier, and I think, you know, at the other end of the spectrum are folks like David, Mike Snyder's another one, but futurists, you know, who really feel that we need to jump to the point where everybody is sequenced. And I think that, you know, I'm a little bit more, I mean, I'm an optimist, absolutely. I'm definitely an evangelist for this technology.
But a grounded optimist.
I like that. I like your word. So I do think that we need to be incremental in the healthcare system. We need to be sure that as we move forward, we're doing it carefully and cautiously, but we should move forward fast. You know, I think that if we have a technology that's better than what we have today, we should immediately try and test it, make sure that we do the right studies to show the circumstances in which is better.
Have you been sequenced? Because there's an interesting, sometimes even this sort of pseudo Twitter debate that sometimes people have, where it turns out that a bunch of people like Eric Land reportedly hasn't been sequenced, but he say, and it's not like for lack of access to the technology, but he said he would be, you know, if he was, you know, God forbid, if he had cancer. And then you have other folks like George Church, who are, you know, an inventor. Right, obviously, yeah, who have been sequenced. Where are you on that continuum?
Yeah, right. So I'm probably near the beginning. I mean, I have been sequenced, and I probably sequenced myself and my immediate family several years ago now, but partly, you know,
is that just to have things to hold against them or to scare them with later when they pissed you off?
Yeah, so they have something to hold against him.
That's exactly how that worked
to me.
Well, what is the point of that, though? I mean, really, what is the point of sequencing everybody at birth? Because, you know, I worry that like the 23andMe phenomenon or some of the others where, you know, all these people get sequenced and they say, holy cow, you've got all these potential things that might go wrong with you, and just create a life of anxiety for people where the things may never come to reality. Back all the way to your point on the athletics, just because you have a gene for being strong doesn't mean you are.
Right, right. Well, it comes down to, I think, your approach to information and data. And Mike says this often, Mike Snyder, he says, you know, you shouldn't get yourself sequenced if you're a warrior. You know, so that's a good, you know, if you're someone prone to anxiety, don't get yourself sequenced.
That's just what I would think. That's just why I haven't, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there will be a bunch of things with great uncertainty in them. I mean, there'll be tens of thousands of things with great uncertainty.
So you're not a worrier?
I'm not. I mean, my sense of it is that on a single individual person level, it's especially for somebody who's in, you know, an adult who's reached adulthood without any major issues, the chances that you will find something dramatic in your genome are very, very small. But if you then extend that to a population, then across a population of people, you will begin to find things where you can save people from significant future disease. One study we did of just 12 people a few years back, we find someone who hadn't otherwise been screened or wasn't otherwise paying any particular attention, who had a significant well-recognized variant in one of the BRCA genes, and so was at significant risk of breast and ovarian cancer. And if she hadn't been sequenced, she wouldn't know that. We have diseases like familial hypercholesterolemia in my realm in cardiology that can lead to people having heart attacks in their 20s. And we do have a test that would tell the small number of people in our society who'd be at risk for that they're at risk, so they don't wait till they're 25 and actually have the heart attack. And so I think that on a population level, there are some arguments that make sense when this technology gets cheap enough to do it, or on a healthcare system level, it may make sense to do that. But I've never been an evangelist to the point of thinking everybody should have this done. I mean, it's very important that people get good counseling and get good understanding of what they may or may not learn. And much more importantly, as you pointed out, the uncertainty surrounding anything they might learn.
So given, I'm going to go back to a question we didn't quite answer before, which is given where we are, the end of the beginning, as you would say, and given that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of dollars of investment have been made in personalized medicine targeted companies, I don't mean tools companies like David's, but things that have a purported endpoint, can anybody make money in this field if the exit has to be within 5 to 7 years, or are we talking a long time?
Well, yeah, I think that's a very good question, because I think that when we started doing this in probably 2008 was the first genome we started, really started to think carefully about what a genome within the medical structure would look like. We had back then, there were only five individuals who had been sequenced. And at that time, I think if you said to me, you know, where will you be in 5 years? Being the optimist, I really would have thought that genomic medicine would be much more mainstream than it is. But this quote from Bill Gates, I think, often comes back to me. I think most people underestimate or overestimate what they can do in a year, but underestimate the change that will happen in 10. And I think that that's where genomic medicine is. I think that the curve is not linear. And I think that there is momentum gathering now. It has been slow to date. I think, particularly for pharmacogenomics, David mentioned this earlier, I think our feeling was that pharmacogenomics was just coming. You know, it was such an obvious demonstration of the potential power of this. It fit into the way we already think about prescribing. And even within our electronic medical records, we already thought about the interactions between drugs. So the idea of thinking about interactions between a drug and your genome, that was straightforward. But, you know, 5, 6, 7 years later, we're no closer really with pharmacogenomics to implementing it on a very broad scale, because that genetic information is not available at the point of care. You still have to have a genetic test in order.
Yeah, it's not in the EMR.
Exactly. But if it was, doctors universally say they would use it. And so that's the difference.
Wait a minute. Hang on. Wait, can I got to push back on that, because I think that so an alternative view on some of this, we got to talk about this,
yeah.
Ewan, is so your view is sort of like, oh, if only the data were available, people would do it. But the flip side is that if this information was actually useful, then it would be made, then it would be available. I think that I kind of always thought one of the big issues around pharmacogenomics is that its utility in not in every case, but in many cases, it's really overstated. Everyone talks about all the times where it's influenced, you know, where it is involved in the processing of a drug. But in many cases, it's, you know, it is just a small fraction of the overall variability that's seen. And so having, it's unclear how having that information would really change the prescribing, or if a prescribing should really change on the basis of that versus anything else. I mean, I thought that the warfarin studies, you know, federally funded, were really interesting. I mean, they did all these studies about whether genetic, you know, doing genetic testing, even if you had it, would really make a lot of that much of a difference. And you know, versus essentially going low, going slow, and doing it empirically. And it I don't think that the takeaway was, oh my gosh, this is going to be, all these lives are going to be saved if you could do it. I think the result was that, wow, this is like a whole amount of testing for something that is unlikely to be that impactful. And my sense is that if there were more examples where genetic testing would have an obvious clinical impact, then it's more likely that it would be embraced. So it's a little bit of chicken and egg, but you actually know what you're talking about, Ewan, so I'd be even more interested in your perspective on this, including the warfarin stuff.
Well, and let me just add, by the way, there is a lot of data available in the AMR that they don't use at all either, even though it is available.
Okay, yeah, so there's way too many things to deal with in one go. Let me try going backwards. First of all, with the EMR, I agree, of course, like with huge panels of data, like with thousands of things that nobody looks at. But if you prescribe something that interacts with something else, then a thing flashes up on your screen and says, hey, do you know about this interaction? And it's very annoying, and you have to click it to make it disappear before you're allowed to prescribe that. So that's obviously the model.
Right.
You know, when this came to the point that we were ready to do it, that would be the model. So it wouldn't be possible to ignore it.
Yeah, that works pretty well when you see only one doctors from one system, but it doesn't work at all when you see doctors in multiple health systems.
Well, solving the rest of the healthcare system, I think we probably have to...
but go ahead, go back to the genetics, even
day.
The genetics you
yeah,
are.
Yeah, yeah. Let me go. My first reaction in talking about pharmacogenomics, I definitely want to deal with the evidence-based aspect. But if you think about the decision that is made anytime a physician decides to prescribe a drug, and particularly in an in-hospital setting, but this is really the case outside as well, doctors are very good at uncertainty, because they live in a world of uncertainty. We have evidence, we have data from trials, but in reality, every single patient is an individual, and every decision you ever make is an individual decision. And so what you're doing is trying to integrate all the information that you believe is relevant to make that decision, whether it's a prescribing decision or not. If it's a prescribing decision, then for many of the drugs, or most of the ones that you're used to dealing with, you have some understanding of whether it's metabolized through the liver or the kidney, or a little bit. I mean, and certainly the major interactions, but most doctors carry those around in their head, at least for the drugs they use a lot. And so if you have a patient whose renal function is poor, or whose liver function is off for some other reason, you integrate that into your decision making. There isn't a randomized trial. There isn't, you know, the data relating to exactly how that cytochrome system deals with or with those kind of liver function tests, exactly what the effect on the drug metabolism will be. That's in some coffer way back in the day, was tested by the pharma company. It's not available. But at some level, you're advised to take account of the mechanism of metabolism as you prescribe. It's not done in a way that there's a very specific trial for exactly those kind of people. And I feel that while I agree with you that our evidence base isn't exactly what it should be, and we do need more evidence that's based around actual change in decision making and then looking at outcome, I think if we make the bar for that every single pharmacogenomic decision that has to be made has to be a randomized controlled trial of this versus another, you know, that's a, yeah, and it's a much higher bar than we've had for the current approach to prescribing, which is to take more generally account of just what we know about the metabolism of the drug. And the reality of clinical medicine is it's pretty messy, and it's very individual. Like you try a drug. I mean, the other thing is, like, where are we today? Like, we're looking for hypertension. Like, somebody comes in and, you know, there's basically you have a few drugs and you try one and they go, well, that didn't work. So you try another one. They go, well, that gave me a cough. You say, okay, well, let's try this one. And I mean, that's what personalized medicine is today. So, you know, non-inferiority is the key here. You know, can we do better than we're currently doing rather than, you know, so.
Nothing like high standards, huh? So what do you think, I'm thinking about how poorly, you know, we've done in terms of science and data around genetic diversity, or gender diversity and ethnic diversity in studies. And I'm wondering how we're doing on the genetic front. Are these companies who are using genetic data to create new products or new solutions or new cures or whatever, are they doing a good job of representing the population truly? Because I know some of the early genetics companies were sequencing their male, you know, executives, and that was the basis for the work they were doing. And I'm wondering, are we doing better than that now? Are there adequate representations of women and minorities and whatever? In the databases that are coming together to do this work?
Very timely question, Lisa.
Yeah. We are doing way better than we used to, but that is also not a reason for us to sit back and think we're where we need to be. I mean, to give you an idea, in clinical genetic testing, within the my lifetime of doing it, you know, which is in the last decade, we used to say that there's a new, we'd send a test, there'd be a new variant that hadn't been seen before in a gene, and to test whether it had been seen before in the population, there were something like 100 anonymous blood donors. That was where we were. And if it wasn't seen in 100 anonymous blood donors, ethnicity unknown, gender unknown, then we would say, well, maybe that could cause disease because it's not been seen before. If we switch to today, we have available, certainly at a web browser, 60,000 and soon to be, I think, 120,000 individuals who were recruited for various reasons in the exome aggregation consortium that we can look up in clinic. I mean, when the ESP data, first of all, from the exome sequencing program, and then this exact data was made available, it instantly was used in clinical medicine. My genetic counselor was looking up variants like that afternoon. And so the extent to which we are doing better than we used to, because also there is some ethnic diversity in those cohorts. But are we where we need to be? We're definitely not. And so from that point of view, I'm happy that NHGRI and other large institutions are now funding efforts aimed at correcting that imbalance.
There's also companies that are sponsoring a collection of genetic samples at things like 49er games and, you know, other weird public locales. What do you think of that?
I didn't know they were doing that, actually.
Oh, yeah. I'll send you a story about it. It's crazy.
Sounds like an interesting idea. But as long as we're representing the world, you know, then I do think that is got to be, I would have to welcome that.
Do you want to just mention that Zach paper in a New England Journal that specifically spoke? Because, you know, when we think about diversity, sometimes it's discussed in what strikes me as like a politically correct context, like, oh, well, it's the thing that's, you know, one should think about doing. But it's beyond, in addition to being the right thing to do, it's an utter scientific necessity to try to make correct conclusions. And I think that was one of the findings of that of the paper by Zach Kahaney's group, wasn't it, in a recent New England Journal?
Yeah, and you know, I think huge credit to them for really bringing attention to an area that doesn't have enough attention on it. I mean, in reality, this is something we've dealt with on a weekly basis. You know, as I mentioned, from a decade ago where we had really no information to really every day in clinic. When we look to the cohort we have, we say, well, is that control cohort ethnically matched? And if it's not, then we're very wary because there are lots of examples, and we've known that for years. I think that the great the credit that they have is, I think, for bringing attention to this and for the because a lot of people have come up to me since and went, wow, that was amazing. I didn't know that. And from our point of view, we're saying, well, that we deal with that every week. But clearly, if lots of people who work in this area didn't know that, then it was something that needed to be laid out. And I think they laid it out very nicely, actually, in my area of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is a disease that has a higher profile than even its frequency in population might suggest, because it has been the cause of the downfall and sudden death of many of our prominent sports players.
Wow. It's a really incredibly interesting time. We only have really a moment for just almost to wrap up, but what's the one thing that you're working on? I know you're involved in almost an embarrassing number of activities. What of the many different things you're working on are you most excited? If you had to pick one, are you most excited about right now?
Well, you know, I think maybe going back to the undiagnosed diseases program, because although we talk genomics around that and we talked about what genomics can do, I think that I'm most excited about what the next thing is there, because although we solve 40% of those cases, there's still 60% of people in whom we don't have the answer. And so we are looking in all directions for that. The environment is one, a very important one to look at. We've looked at the genome, the epigenome becomes important, but also the immune system, I think, is very exciting. And in particular, bringing genomic technology to the immune system is something I'm very excited about, because in the past, we've had one or two antibodies or a small amount of ability to look at T-cell changes. But now we can actually sequence those T-cells and B-cells that are the warriors of the immune system to really get a better idea of what they're doing. So I think the power of high-throughput technology can be brought to the immune system and start to redefine autoimmune disease for us, which I think is really one of the most exciting areas that we're moving into.
Well, you know, a couple of shows ago, we interviewed Diego Morales, who is now president of Adaptive Biotechnologies, and he's trying to work on the therapeutic part. But clearly, that's a company that's really trying to focus on applying at least analytics to the results of next generation sequencing in the area of the immune system, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I think immunotherapy, of course, is what's become very hot for in oncology and for cancer. And I think that, you know, again, we're at the early stages of that, but it does look very promising. But I think just a short step away from applying immune therapy to cancer is thinking about actual disease that has its primary basis in the immune system and autoimmunity and autoinflammatory disease. And so I do think that that's our next frontier, and certainly one that we're aiming pretty hard at.
Wow. Well, we're so grateful. We know we only touched on a tiny fraction of all the things that you're involved in, which means we'll have to have you back on the show soon.
We'd love to do that.
Thank you so much.
Terrific to talk to you today. Thank you so much, Ewan.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Ewan Ashley is a cardiologist, geneticist, and digital health pioneer at Stanford.
As a referee in youth soccer, when he calls a foul, kids thank him. Genomes make maps of him. He plays jazz saxophone, Afro-Peruvian jazz.
He does.
His favorite single malt scotch is so prized and so rare, they make it only for him. He wrote a textbook on cardiology waiting for a friend at an airport. He just might be the most interesting man in Silicon Valley.
I don't always appear on podcasts, but when I do, I prefer Tectonics.
That is awesome.
Boy, that guy's amazing. He does it all.
Well, you can follow Lisa Soonan at VentureValkyrie.com, as well as on the Timmerman Report.
And David Shaywitz can be found at Forbes.com.
We're grateful to our sponsor, DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant and always interesting cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data. Tectonics is produced by Connected Social Media and recorded in Tectonics Studio B in scenic Mill Valley, California.
Tectonics, the most interesting podcast in the world.
Stay healthy, my friends.